Hello, I'm Eleanor Betts, lecturer in classical studies at the Open University and a member of the A340 module team. Visitors to Rome still flock here to the Pantheon, one of the city's most iconic buildings, completed by the Emperor Hadrian in 125 CE and converted into a church in 608. It is remarkable for its architecture, which was unparalleled until the Renaissance, and until 1958, its domed roof was the largest concrete span in the world. But standing here inside the building, despite the crowds, the most striking aspect I can see is the hole, or oculus, in the coffered dome. This opening, 30 Roman feet across, lets in sunlight, moonlight, rain, and birds. The circular oculus makes sunlight cast a beam, like a floodlight, on the wall. And like a floodlight, this beam moves around the interior. Whereabouts it does that depends on the season and the time of day. The coffering now has been stripped of its bronze gilt, but a Roman visitor would have been dazzled by the reflected light, and this would have allowed them to see the multicoloured marbles on the walls and the floor. Most of the marble we can see here today has been replaced since the 2nd century, but we get a flavour of the Hadrianic Pantheon and what it would have looked like, with its surfaces covered in yellow and white, grey and green, red and purple stone, and its floor patterned with alternating circles and squares. And all this brought from the furthest reaches of the empire, from Turkey, Tunisia, from Greece and Egypt. And we also get a great sense of the sounds. The circular space is great for acoustics. If we go outside, we find that the structure of the Pantheon is incredibly complex. And if I walk out into the porch between the Egyptian granite columns, which reach 40 Roman feet high, I need to go across the piazza to get a good view of the exterior. The Pantheon is essentially made up of a circular drum, the rotunda, and its amazing roof, and a porch with the appearance of a traditional Roman temple. The section which joined these two architectural features looks a bit strange, as if it's there to join the two parts which don't quite fit together. I think the architects had some fun with this building. From one angle, the low profile but massive 150 Roman feet, dome and rotunda dominate the square. But from another angle, all I can see is the porch, which looks like the entrance to a traditional rectangular Roman temple. The triangular pediment of the porch is emblazoned with a Latin inscription. M for Marcus Agrippa, L, F, Cos, Tertium, Facit. Marcus Agrippa, son of Lucius, consul three times, made this. But we know the building is Hadrianic, but that inscription tells us that it was built to replace the Pantheon built by Agrippa, the Emperor Augustus' right-hand man. And this is not the only unusual feature. If we look closely at the porch, the proportions seem all wrong. It's too low. To find out more about these peculiarities, I'm going to go and talk to Mark Wilson-Jones, who has devoted much of his career to studying the Pantheon. So, Mark, my first question that I'd like to ask you is, what was it that first interested you in the Pantheon?
Well, the Pantheon's one of those buildings that compels architects. I was a young architect in Rome, and you go around and see lots of monuments, but you just get drawn back to the Pantheon time and again. It's a kind of magnet. You get a buzz in the building, and you basically feel good, and I think that's an essential part of it. There's also, it's been a favourite building of so many architects, whether you take it back in time to the Renaissance, it's like the top of their shopping lists, if you like. And then even an architect like Louis Kahn in the 20th century would be inspired by the Pantheon. The Pantheon is a kind of ancestor for so many progeny, so many different periods, that you get mini pantheons here and there all over the world. So even if you haven't seen it before, you have this sense of déjà vu when you approach it. So you kind of feels like an old friend. And then it's got so many wonderful spatial qualities, particularly interior. When you watch people inside, they go in and they hang around. They move around, they're just fascinated, and they take quite a long time before they come out.
Okay, so I would have thought we knew everything there was to know about a standing building like the Pantheon, but is that the case?
Well, I call the building an enigma because it really is. It poses as many riddles as it answers, and it has strange features. You read such a thing as the inscription on the front says, effectively, Agrippa did this, only he didn't. At least he didn't do the actual building. And you just start from there, and you get a whole series of puzzles. You know, it's not like a temple, but it is like a temple in some ways. It's visually wonderful in parts, and others it's a bit curious, if not to say maybe flawed. So it poses the whole range of questions.
The building we see today is usually referred to as the Hadrianic Pantheon, because we know it was completed by Hadrian, but as you just said with the inscription, and this sort of, there's a mismatch here. So what evidence have you found that the phasing is more complicated?
Well, it's a controversy as well, because they only discovered that the building was built in the imperial period in the late 19th century. So you have that name Agrippa there on the front to contend with. And then the bricks were originally attributed to the time of Hadrian. And then there's a big grand specialist block in the 20th century who realised that some of the bricks were from the reign of Trajan, but he still liked the idea of Hadrian building it. So he rationalised that by thinking that they were stockpiled, these bricks were stockpiled. And then recent reappraisals show that actually most of the bricks that we can definitely identify in terms of date, often to within an exact year, are in fact Trajanic. So it suggests, yes, that Hadrian completed the building, but he wasn't the mastermind behind the project.
OK, so tell me a little bit more about that. So how, maybe what was Trajan's involvement?
We can never be too precise who does what, but we do know the building burnt down in 110. Okay, so that's the previous manifestation, either built by Agrippa, possibly remodeled by Domitian. But anyway, we have the pre-existing building burning down in 110 AD. So then there's presumably some gap while they clear the site and devise the new project. And building gets underway, we presume, about 113, 114. That's the current working assumption. And then we have Hadrian only, say, 3-4 years later after it started, coming to power. And at that point, you may have various problems we can identify in terms of the physical structure may coincide with this transition. And then Hadrian, of course, invests a lot of energy behind the building. It's the grandest interior ever built. I think we can imagine major festivals, events carried out at the Pantheon with Hadrian there.
Okay, great. So let's think a little bit more then about the architecture. So can you tell me a little bit more about the way the porch and the rotunda fit together? And why do you think there is a bit of a mismatch between these two parts of the building?
Well, when you approach the Pantheon, especially if you, say, come from the other side of the portico, you know, the rotunda is vast. It's absolutely huge. And when you come that way, the portico is strangely small. Of course, if you come straight into the portico and you look up at it, you know, the columns are huge and so on. It's when you get a distance, it's when you can go away from a perspective view or from a roof level or from in the air, you see that actually the portico is rather small. And it's surprisingly small given the grandeur of the interior. But then it's particularly the junction that's problematic. You get these elements, if you like, crashing together, colliding. You could think of the junction as a dog's breakfast. It looks improvised. It looks casual. It doesn't look deliberate.
So why do you think that is?
Well, I think it's interesting to start with other people's opinions, like Michelangelo, people like that. They thought that the building couldn't have been built in one go. And he had the theory that the lower part of the interior was built by an architect that was as good as an angel. Then there was a second architect, and then there were a third who added the portico. So this kind of idea that the different parts of the building, and to make sense of that in your own mind, you can imagine these different phases. And the idea of phases has been used time and time again to explain it. But the problem is that when it got to the late 19th century, and the building could be shown by the study of the brick stamps, and then the foundations as well, that it was all built in one go, then people were stuck. There's a kind of crisis. And people come up with strange explanations. Oh, well, the Romans didn't really worry about neatness in our sense. They weren't so academic, their architects. Or that perhaps even Hadrian, he designed it and he wasn't so good as architecture. Obviously, he wasn't a full-time architect. Or you get ideas like the portico is a Greek concept and the rotunda is a Roman concept. Therefore, they're difficult to combine and this is the result we get. There are various explanations like that.
So what's your own view?
Well, I came to this just as a young architect with a curious mind, looking at the building, and I thought it looked really kind of odd, without knowing all these things that I now know. So I would just ask well-informed friends, art historians and so on, what's the explanation? And then you read Vasari, you learn about Michelangelo's opinion, you come across people like Fontana or these other great names down the centuries. And you, in a sense, you kind of grapple with their interpretations. But fundamentally, I just couldn't believe that it was meant to be as it was. It didn't strike me as possible that the building was actually intended to be like this. So as an architect, we know that things can go wrong on building sites. For whatever reason, they can be legion, a very disparate nature. But quite often buildings are not the same as the plans were originally devised. Something happens, something maybe goes wrong, there's changes of mind. And I kind of had the intuition that it was something like that that was the lay behind these things. Because, to repeat, it's not built in phases. It's all built in one go, but it still looks somewhat weird.
So what is it that's going wrong there?
Really, the problem is with the height of the portico. And if it were simply bigger and taller, taller being the key point, it would then sort of fit the rotunda, both in terms of general scale, but also in terms of particular details. And there's various technical details that when you look at them, such as strange capitals that are asymmetric and, if you like, lopsided, that would simply not have existed in the original building with a taller portico. Now, the columns are in three parts: bases, shafts, and capitals. The critical thing are the shaft. They're monoliths. Those of the present building are 40 foot tall. They come from Egypt. They weigh 50 tons. There's 16 of them. That's extremely impressive in its own right. However, what we have to imagine is that they wanted 50 foot shafts. They would have weighed 100 tons each, and they're still coming from Egypt, presumably. So that's an enormous feat of building, which the Romans could do because a few other 50 foot shafts did arrive in Rome from the same granite. So we can imagine that they could do it. They wanted to do it also for the Pantheon, and something went wrong with that plan.
That's fairly understandable. I mean, carving those columns and transporting them must be a real feat of engineering and transportation.
It is an incredible feat. It's almost unimaginable. In terms of building today, people get extremely exercised about weights of 2 tons, 5 tons. 20 tons is a very big deal. So we're talking, originally they would have wanted each piece, 100 tons, has to be moved to the Nile. From one quarry, that's over 70 kilometres away. Transferring to the Nile barges, shipping down to Alexandria, then they need to be moved onto seagoing vessels, shipped to the port of Rome, and then the same process inverted, so to speak, in reverse, to then get the columns up the Tiber, dock them near the Mausoleum of Augustus, and then erect them. I mean, it's an extraordinary business.
It must have been quite a spectacle as well.
I think it's one of the ways that the Romans demonstrated the power they had, their dominion over the world. It's part of the demonstration of their bulls and bravado.
So something then went wrong, but even so, we've still got 40-foot tall columns. Still going to impress the people of Rome. Okay, anything else that you want to say about the portico and the rotunda?
Well, there's still lots of things to learn. I mean, I'd love to know how the dome was built, you know, whether you had centering, whether you didn't. The dome strikes you immediately because it has this oculus at the centre, no other source of light. So that gives it this mystical, transcendental quality. You only see the clouds through it or the moon and the stars. You get no views of normal things. So it's got this inevitable sort of cosmic reverberation about it. And the light changes throughout the course of the day. So that is kind of a large secret, if you like, of the presence it has, of the compelling quality. And then there's the size, because it's almost a span of 44 metres. That was not far short of 150 Roman feet. And that's done with unreinforced concrete. So there's no metal there, as there would be in modern concrete. And it is a triumph of engineering. There's the grading of materials that's very significant. The rotunda is 20 foot thick, but it's not all built solid. There are the chambers inside that serve to lighten the amount of the sheer weight of the building and allow the concrete to go off. There's all kinds of ingenious technical devices that allow this apparently very simple structure to actually stand.
Amazing. So what do you think the Pantheon was actually for?
The purpose of the Pantheon is one of these puzzles. We don't really know. We don't know if it's a temple. It has many temple-like qualities. There's a text that implies that the building was to have been a temple for Augustus, but Augustus declined the offer. And this shows you, you're dealing with a very tricky edge between divinity and mortality, that the building was, if you like, negotiating. So on the one hand, it's got temple-like features, particularly the pediment at the front. That sort of announces a temple. But it has a very strange inscription, not like other temples. And it has this great round hall, not like other temples, because the gods generally did not share the same interior. So many things that are not, if you like, standard.
Right, yeah, so a normal temple would just be dedicated to one god rather than all the gods.
Yes, yeah. A normal temple, one god. There's the Venus in Rome, there's two gods. There's the Capitoline Triad, three gods. But a temple to the Capitoline Triad has three separate spaces. And they're usually rectangular. So the circular concept, it goes back to Hellenistic models where effectively what they're doing is they're putting the ruler and perhaps members of his family and associates in the company of the gods, so that the sort of divine qualities of the gods are rubbing off on these mortal figures. But they're, especially in the context of Rome, they don't actually want to claim immortality and divinity for Augustus in his own lifetime. But he's going to become divine when he dies. The axis of the pantheon points at the mausoleum of Augustus. So there's all this implicit negotiation, say, on the edge of what is acceptable.
So how does the pantheon fit in with the rest of the architectural landscape of the Campus Martius?
What's important to realise here is that the pantheon isn't born in the centre of Rome, as we think of it. The Campus Martius was the field of war, military exercises, and it was marshy. It's surrounded by the Tiber, and it wasn't until it was drained in the first century BC that you start getting it populated by buildings. And they tend to be freestanding complexes that were clearly designed and set out and often symmetrical in character, quite different to what was happening in the rest of the city. So you have these grand complexes, and a particularly important part is that in terms of where its location is, this was the land that belonged to Agrippa. So Agrippa is Augustus's right-hand man. So you have this kind of union there. And then it's said pointing to the mausoleum of Augustus. And there's other particular features of this is that the spot that the pantheon rises on might be that you can identify with the Padus Caprae. So that's the marsh of goats. And this is the spot where, according to legend, or one legend, there were others, this is the spot where Romulus had his apotheosis. So he rose to the heavens, became the god Quirinus. So possibly Agrippa and Augustus, I mean, I think we must see this as a sort of combined venture. So Agrippa, nominally the patron, is grasping for Augustus an identification with Romulus. So this is another aspect that sort of important for the site itself.
In which case we see maybe Trajan and or Hadrian then sort of emulating that and trying to sort of piggyback on that Agrippa and Augustine reference back to the foundation myths.
Yes, I think the pantheon, it starts off, let's say, as a dynastic statement for Augustus and then also Agrippa, who becomes united in the family through marriage, in effect. So it starts off as a dynastic statement, but then with the passage of, you know, successive emperors, it becomes a more general celebration of empire. So as people come along, you're building up, if you like, the inheritance. And so naturally, Trajan would want to consolidate that. Hadrian too. And then successive emperors. So it becomes a natural thing to sort of join the club.
Okay. So one final question. Is there anything else then that you still want to know about the pantheon?
Well, I would love to know how it was built. I'd love to know what the original bronze roof of the portico looked like, because that was only dismantled in 1628, a total cultural disaster. That there existed a bronze roof with ceiling, vaulted ceilings, in the portico that came down to, say, until 1628, when it was dismantled to make a cannon, would you believe? Yeah. So, you know, I'd love to know that. We never will know the details. And I'd love to know the relationship with the Pantheon of Agrippa and ideally get into spaces underneath the Pantheon floor, try and work out things about the junctions. I would, you know, the dream of anyone investigating the Pantheon would start drilling into bits of the fabric where you could to get core samples and to be able to dissect it and work out certain things that would, if you like, refine the story. I mean, it would be lovely to have an anatomy exercise and take it apart, but of course we can't, because it is, after all, a church. And the Tomb of Kings and great artists, including Raphael and so on.
Yeah, of course. So there is still plenty that we could learn about this standing and amazing building.
Yep, no, there's still more it can teach us.
Well, thank you very much, Mark. Thanks for talking to me today.
That's a pleasure.
Very interesting. Yeah.